From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. This fall, Illinois is the scene of a historic U.S. Senate race between two nationally known African-American candidates. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with both. Barack Obama is a rising star of the Democratic Party who delivered the keynote address at their national convention. And he's just updated and republished a highly personal 1996 memoir about his life and search for racial identity. Republican Alan Keyes is an outspoken conservative commentator who's run for president twice. He'll tell us why he's already accused his opponent of holding the slaveholder's position on a critical issue. Obama and Keyes coming up today on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Thousands of American troops sealed off Najaf Cemetery, its old city, and an important Shiite shrine today and started an assault against militants loyal to Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. A military spokesman said major operations to destroy the militia have begun. A political bombshell today in the Garden State. James McGreevy, the first-term Democratic governor of New Jersey, declared he is a gay American and said he had had an extramarital affair with another man and announced he would resign effective November 15th. NPR's Ken Rudin reports.
For the longest time, McGreevy and his administration were under investigation for fundraising-related scandals. So it was surprising that it was his personal conduct that seems to have ended his political career. Reports say that McGreevy, who was accompanied by his wife and parents at his news conference, has been hit with a sexual harassment lawsuit, and that is what led to his decision to resign. Had he quit immediately, instead of as of November 15th, a special election for governor would have been placed on the fall ballot. And Democratic sources in New Jersey tell NPR that the Kerry campaign, which holds a double-digit lead in the state, didn't want to risk the chance of having the focus in November go from the Bush administration to the McGreevy administration. Ken Rudin, NPR News.
President Bush went looking for the votes of union members at a stop in Las Vegas this afternoon. He called the economy strong in a speech before the Brotherhood of Carpenters Union. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Las Vegas.
During his first term in office, the president has actively courted the Carpenters Union. In Las Vegas, he said tax cuts have given the economy a boost, helping building trades. He was warmly received, but this wasn't a rally, and it wasn't hard to find people in the audience who are ambivalent about the president. 35-year-old Joe Newton sat just a few rows from the stage. He's not as optimistic as Mr. Bush on the economy.
I think that a lot of people are in the same situation, sort of on the fence about a lot of different issues, but the most important issue is how are we going to feed our families, what's going to create jobs for us.
Mr. Bush is hoping for the carpenters' endorsement, but Union President Douglas McCarron says a decision won't come until next month. Don Gagne, NPR News, with the president in Las Vegas.
Democrat John Kerry campaigned in California today, where he criticized the idea of a national sales tax President Bush says deserves a look.
To switch to a national sales tax without increasing the deficit, which is what they said they do, you'd have to have at least a 26% add-on on top of the state and local sales taxes that Americans already pay. And we know exactly who that's going to hurt. That's going to hurt small businesses. It's going to hurt jobs. It's going to hit the pocketbooks of those who need and deserve tax relief most in America.
Kerry also said the Bush administration's tax cuts have not created the jobs the president promised. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 123 points today to close at 98.14. The Nasdaq Composite was down 29 at 17.52. This is NPR News. Florida officials have ordered evacuations along the state's Gulf Coast as Hurricane Charley moves closer. The hurricane is expected to hit mainland Florida tomorrow. Tropical Storm Bonnie is currently drenching the panhandle. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
400,000 residents of St. Petersburg, Tarpon Springs, and other low-lying areas on the Gulf Coast near Tampa are under orders to leave. Hurricane Charley is expected to hit the area with winds at 100 miles per hour or better. The evacuations not only mean snarled traffic for the Tampa area, but also Orlando, where many of these coastal residents are expected to go. Bill Shooter with the Florida Safety Council in Orlando says those people will crowd shelters and even hotels at the theme parks.
We are going to be catching everybody from either of the coasts, no matter where the storm comes in on either coast. In this situation, they're going to be coming in from the west coast, and so we are the catchment area for it, and the I-75 track going north is going to be pretty crowded.
Charlie is expected to move through west central Florida and up into coastal Georgia and the Carolinas over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins, Orlando.
The California Supreme Court today voided all gay marriages that were sanctioned by San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom last spring. The court ruled Newsom exceeded his authority, ignoring a state law and a voter-approved measure that defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Nearly 4,000 same-sex marriages were sanctioned in San Francisco this year. The court didn't rule on the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. A wildfire has destroyed more than 60 homes and other structures in a north central California community near Shasta Lake. Officials said hundreds of people have evacuated the area. The fire has burned 3,000 acres. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, providing humanitarian aid in Sudan's Darfur region and working to prevent further violence there at ajws.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If there's a rising star in the Democratic Party today, it's the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Illinois, Barack Obama. Chosen to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, Obama spoke on themes of inclusion, unity, and what he called the audacity of hope. Obama's father was from Kenya, who met his mother, a white woman from Kansas, during college. Obama is currently a state senator from Chicago. He fought a seven-way primary to get the U.S. Senate nomination, winning a remarkable 53% of the vote. What's excited party leaders and caught the attention of analysts is his ability to win in white neighborhoods, apparently connecting with voters of all backgrounds. The Senate race in Illinois took a surprising turn when the Republican candidate, Jack Ryan, dropped out after salacious details of his divorce from his wife, actress Jeri Ryan, became public. Last Sunday, the Illinois Republican Party chose conservative commentator Alan Keyes as their new candidate, and we'll speak with him later in the show. Back in 1996, before he'd ever run for office, Barack Obama published a memoir of his life and search for racial identity called Dreams from My Father. It's been updated and is being published again this week. I spoke to Barack Obama on Tuesday. We began by talking about his family background.
Well, you know, my father was part of that first generation of Africans who traveled to the United States to get an education. Their plan was to return to their country, bring back technology, sort of like Promethean fire, to help develop these newly independent countries. He met my mother in Hawaii at the University of Hawaii while they were both studying. And this is in the early 60s, and so, you know, obviously at that time mixed marriage was illegal in much of the country, but Hawaii, because of its cultural diversity and you know, the unique status that it had as an island state, I think was more accommodating. Nevertheless, the strains and tensions of the two cultures, I think, led my parents to separate relatively young. So he returned to Kenya after studying at Harvard. I did not end up knowing him particularly well. My mother remarried an Indonesian. I moved to Jakarta. And you know, my memories, both of Hawaii and Jakarta, I think, were significant in my ongoing development. Hawaii, because it is such a cultural melting pot, probably unique in the United States for having so many different competing cultures, none of which are dominant or assertive. But it taught me, I think, the possibilities of different cultures living side by side. Indonesia, just because it was a fascinating country, and for a six-year-old boy running around rice paddies and riding water buffalo and dealing with, you know, all the excitement and also challenges of a third-world country in the late 60s, I think was to have a significant mark on my life for many years to come, particularly the huge gaps in wealth that existed there. I think it made me more mindful of not only my blessings as a U.S. citizen, but also the ways that fate can determine the lives of young children so that one ends up being fabulously wealthy and another ends up being extraordinarily poor.
You wrote that your mom became aware of power and how it can be used to abuse people. And you also write, your mom thought it was important to instill in you values of honesty and fairness, and that you write that her only ally in all this was the distant authority of your father. You wrote that she told you that you have her to thank for your eyebrows, but your brains and your character you got from him. What was the image of your father that you carried for all those years of your youth?
Well, you know, that's one of the finest gifts that my mother ever gave me. You know, I think a lot of parents, when they separate, there's a lot of bitterness there. And partly just because my mother's wonderful spirit, partly because my father was this very imposing, almost mythic figure, not only to my mother, but to the people that he met during the brief time he was in Hawaii. He ended up becoming this figure of great authority. You know, he was famous for his intelligence and his charm and his loquaciousness. And as a consequence, you know, I ended up having this extraordinarily positive image of being black, and that there was no reason to think that the stereotypes that, you know, I would learn subsequently about African-Americans that were still rampant and to some degree still are rampant ever applied to me.
You eventually returned to Hawaii and were raised in large part by your white grandparents, your mom's parents. But as I read the memoir, it was clear that by high school, you clearly had an identity as a black American. And I wonder, do you feel that that was a choice you made, or that it was made by the world you inhabited? Did American culture make that choice for you?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think that as I said before, my attitude about being black was always positive. The associations within my family were positive. And so it wasn't something that I was fearful of or disturbed by. You know, when I was an awkward teen, you know, the trouble I had didn't have to do with being black. It had to do with the fact that I had this funny name, Barack Obama, and you know, you always want to fit in. You wish your name was Tim Smith, but certainly the society had something to do with it as well. You know, recently, now that I've been getting a lot of attention in the political arena, there are a number of commentators who've asked me about, well, you know, you're half white. Why do you call yourself African American? I give two responses. One, I think the term African American already describes a hybrid culture. We are a hybrid people. We are a people that are native to this country and partake of all the cultural cross currents that exist. The second thing is the fact that if I'm trying to catch a cab in Manhattan, you know, the drivers are looking at me and they're saying, "Well, there's a black guy out there hailing a cab," you know, that's an identity that I welcome and embrace, and it's a tradition that I draw from. I don't feel it's something that I need to shy away from, and I don't feel that it's contradictory to take that position and still embrace the fact that I had this wonderful side of my family that was white, and the values that they instilled in me are ones that I still care about, precisely because I don't think they're white or black values, but I think they're human values.
So you grew up largely in Hawaii, and you had this image of your dad as a man of enormous accomplishment and character, which your mom had kept in your mind. And then
right. There
was one real visit that he made when you were 10. What are your recollections of that?
Well, you know, what was remarkable, and I devote a chapter of the book to this, is the degree to which he somehow was able to live up to these images that I had. He was imposing, and he was impressive, and he did sort of change the space around him when he walked into a room. I didn't know at the time, and would only know subsequently when I traveled to Kenya and met my family there, that he was actually struggling and having an enormously difficult time. But his capacity to establish an image for himself of being in command was in full force, and had an impressive effect on a 10-year-old boy. It was funny, later in life, you know, I would realize how much that brief visit and interaction with him altered me in all sorts of ways, some of which I don't even notice, but my mother would notice later. You know, habits of how I speak, or you know, how I gesture. And it just reminds you, I think, of what a powerful force parents are in their children's lives.
You studied at a prep school in Hawaii that you were lucky enough to get into, which it seems like it was not an easy time. And it seems like the time when you were in high school seems to be the one episode in your life when you seemed to lose some motivation and your grades slipped and, you know, you smoked marijuana with your buddies. And I'm kind of wondering, what, in retrospect, what was going on then? What was troubling you?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things going on. One is the absence of a father, I think, has the most profound effect on teenage boys, because it's right at that time where they're dealing with hormones and they're trying to figure out, you know, how do I assert myself in this world and who am I? And you know, when you don't have clear models, you start trying to pick models off the rack. That's a period in time where I think I fell into the trap that a lot of African-American youth fall into, and that is these exaggerated stereotypes about how I should behave, that I should rebel against academic achievement, or I should concentrate all my attention on sports, or I should dabble in drugs. And it wasn't until I reached college that I started recognizing that I had bought into a set of false assumptions about what it meant to be black. But part of it, you know, the culture was powerful. I mean, keep in mind, this is a time when, you know, Shaft and Superfly and, you know, that's one alternative. And then the other alternative is Flip Wilson in a wig. You know, if you had to choose between those two, you know, Shaft seemed to be the better deal. I don't want to overstate this, because I think in a lot of ways, I wasn't that different from a lot of teenage kids growing up in the 70s, which is, it was a difficult time for the country generally.
My guest is Barack Obama. He is a state senator from Illinois and currently a candidate for the U.S. Senate. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Barack Obama. He is a candidate for the United States Senate in Illinois. He is also a state senator and the author of a memoir, Dreams from My Father. So you graduate high school. You go to college in Los Angeles, Occidental College, if I recall.
Right.
And eventually you make contact with one of your sisters from Kenya. Alma, right. Do I have her name correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And you eventually get together for a several-day meeting, and it's interesting to me that for a while you don't talk about your father, then eventually the time is right. And she tells the story, the kind of the story that you haven't heard about your dad. And tell us what she told you and what its effect was on you.
Well, what was fascinating was to hear her speak. She had studied in Germany, was visiting me while I was actually had moved to Chicago by this time. I'd graduated from Columbia University in New York, had worked for as an organizer for about 6 months, had moved to Chicago to continue community organizing work out in the far south side of Chicago, working with churches that were trying to deal with the devastation of steel plants closing in the area. And she made contact and came to visit me in Chicago. And it was at that point that I learned that my father had a very troubled life. He had passed away at this point. I'd gotten a call while I was in New York that he had been killed in a car accident. When she came to visit, she explained to me that upon his return to Kenya, he had ended up being caught up with the government in Kenya, but had a falling out in part because he was somebody who was willing to speak out against corruption and nepotism in the government administration there, had been blackballed from the government, had ended up having a alcoholism problem at the same time as he had fallen on very hard times, and so had gone from being a big man with a American education who was prominent in the government to somebody who had to borrow from relatives to support his children. the children that he had had from other marriages in Kenya. And so this image that I had of this very strong, powerful, imposing figure was suddenly balanced by this picture of a very tragic figure who had never been able to really pull all the pieces of his life together again. And, you know, that was a disquieting revelation, obviously, and had to make me re-examine, you know, how high I had been thinking about him and what my expectations were of him. And I think also forced me to grow up a little bit. You know, one of the things that all of us have to face sometime in our lives is the realization that our parents are mortal and fallible. And in some ways, that was delayed for me when it comes to thinking about my father because he wasn't around, so you didn't have a chance to see him age or cry or have difficulties.
Or struggle, yeah.
Or struggle. And really, my sister did see that happen to him in those ways, and it really I think, shook me up ultimately in a healthy way.
It's almost as if holding on to the myth was more important.
Well,
or important, you know, in some way, right?
You know, it's certainly more important to my family. I mean, you know, what's striking was what a vigorous defense they would always mount to my father, and I think that is a testimony to him in some fashion because he really did change their lives. I mean, keep in mind
your Kenyan family, you mean?
Well, no, I'm talking about my mother's family.
Okay,
you know, I think that you know, there was an important transaction that took place between my mother's family and my father, in the sense that, you know, they offered to him some sort of entree into the modern world or to the Western world. But the flip side of it was that he drew them out of the parochialism and ordinariness of a Midwestern Kansas existence. You know, he made their lives different and exciting, and suddenly they had a grandchild who spoke to, you know, Kennedy's New Frontier and Dr. King's magnificent dream. I think that was critical for them as well, certainly critical to my mother, who was somebody who, as a child, I think was always sensing that there was a bigger world out there that somehow she had to access, and she accessed it initially through my father.
Going back to the moment when your sister Alma kind of told you the details of the difficulties your father had had, and you'd realized, I think you said, you know, your gramps, you were used to other people being flawed, but not right. Not Dr. Obama. Give me just a sense of sort of the emotional impact that made on you. What did it feel like?
In some ways, it was liberating because I didn't realize how much I had been trying to chase after his ghost, right? That I'd been arguing with somebody who, in fact, didn't exist. There was probably some sense of relief there. But I think it also made me question myself in all sorts of ways because you often are concerned that if your parents have these flaws, goodness, you know, I'm going to have these flaws too. You know, it's like the big ears I inherited from my grandfather, or the bad back or what have you. You know, you worry that there are elements of their character that have seeped into you unbeknownst to you, and you've got to figure out how you're going to cope with those things. And so it wasn't until I returned to Kenya and had a chance to stand at his grave and my grandfather's grave in a small village named Alego, near Lake Victoria, and wept for him, and understood his journey and my grandfather's journey, and also understood that the best in him wasn't all that different from the best in my white grandfather from Kansas. That, you know, the values that connected my mother and my father were values that I could embrace. That I didn't have to choose between them. It wasn't until that point that I think I was able to come to terms with them.
You're now married. You have a wife, Michelle, two small kids. And, you know, we all wonder, to what extent we're going to become our parents. And I wondered, as I read about how you discovered that your father, who, you know, you'd always thought of as a man of great character and accomplishments and truly was, turned out to be a guy who, you know, had, you know, a polygamy in his past and a tough stretch with some drinking issues. And I'm wondering, do you ever worry whether you'll be able to remain? Does it make you concerned that you won't be able to remain the kind of committed husband and father that I'm sure you want to be?
You know, Lyndon Johnson, who I don't quote that often, had this wonderful saying. He says, every man is trying to live up to his father's expectations or make up for his mistakes. And I guess I'm trying to do both. My father set some high expectations for me and for himself that he couldn't always meet. And I'm trying to live up to those high standards, but also make up for the mistakes that he made, particularly with respect to his family life.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned LBJ because he's an example of a politician, as are a lot of very successful politicians who are rooted in a place. I mean, we know he is a Texan. We know that Harry Truman came from Missouri. Your past seems almost rooted in ideas. I mean, diversity, inclusion, hope. Or is Chicago really your home?
You know, at this point, Chicago really is my home. I mean, the middle section of the book is about Chicago, and that's really where I found my manhood, and I found my home and my roots, because the African American community in Chicago is a wonderfully rich and funky area, and the community that we live in on the south side of Chicago is full of traditions and a strong African American political history, a strong African-American cultural and religious history. And it's really provided me with a base of support, a family, a network that I'm just grateful for every day. And it's the community where my wife grew up. It's a community where we go to church and we raised our kids. And so at this point, I feel very much rooted in that community. But as I've said before, I'm not limited by that community. And I certainly think that one of the gifts that I may bring to bear in my politics is the ability to span across cultures in a way that I think is going to be increasingly important. In an age where not only within our borders but outside our borders, there are a lot of conflicting cultures that have to be drawn together.
Barack Obama. He's currently the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate from Illinois. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of Autumn Bridge, a novel set in 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka, author of Cloud of Sparrows. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, giving the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, we continue our conversation with Barack Obama. And we'll talk with his opponent in a U.S. Senate race, Republican and conservative commentator Alan Keyes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with Barack Obama. He gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, and he's the party's candidate for the U.S. Senate from Illinois. One of the lines that was most quoted from your convention speech was your exhortation to eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. I'm wondering, you, I think at times in your career have been regarded by some African-American politicians as a guy who isn't really a black politician, but sort of some exotic character who, you know, kind of white middle-class folks like to like. How have you confronted that issue?
You know, what's fascinating is it's never been an issue among regular folks on the street. You know, it's never an issue with the bus drivers or the teachers or the guys on the street corner who I'm talking to. This is always an issue that's been brought up in the context of a political situation by professional politicians. And it's a handy shorthand to try to create some separation between me and what's a strong part of my base. But it really is not something that has ended up being a problem for me with respect to the voters. And, you know, we got 90% of the African-American vote in this recent primary, and the turnout was, I think, 30% higher than it had been in the previous election within the African-American community. So clearly they felt that what I was articulating spoke to their lives and their concerns.
Well, one person hopes to find you another way to make a living is Alan Keyes. The Republicans have selected the conservative Alan Keyes to run against you for the Senate seat, and he's come right after you. He accused you, I believe I read, of holding the slaveholder's position on life, a reference to your position on abortion. He's coming after you. What kind of campaign do you expect?
Well, let's see. He's been here 2 days, and so far he's compared me to slaveholders, Nazis, and has justified him coming in from Maryland by comparing the situation in New York after 9/11, suggesting that we were all New Yorkers then, and in the same way he's an Illinoisan now in doing battle with me. You know, that's Mr. Keyes' style. You know, that's his rhetorical styles. But I'll be honest with you. We're going to do the same things that we've been doing throughout. What people really want to see are politicians who attack problems instead of each other. I think people are just weary of this sort of scorched earth, slash and burn politics that demonizes whoever doesn't agree with you. And Democrats, by the way, are complicit in that. I always tell my supporters and my fellow Democrats, or not even Democrats, just people of goodwill who want to see the country move in a better direction, we lose when we engage in that sort of mudslinging. The people that I care about lose, because those are the people, the ordinary folks are most apt to be alienated from the process in that kind of political environment. The people who thrive in those political environments are the professionals. They're the ruthless and the cynical and the people who've got a monetary stake in outcomes and are going to be working the back rooms and the corridors no matter what happens. So I am going to, I'm going to engage Mr. Keyes in a debate on jobs and education and healthcare, and I think that I'm entirely happy to engage with him on a discussion about some of the issues that he's concerned about, issues of abortion or gay rights or wanting to have the Ten Commandments posted in a federal courtroom. I'm happy to talk about those things, but what I'm going to insist on is that we discuss issues not only of private morality, but also public morality, because I think that there are moral questions posed when, you know, we have one out of every three African-American males in prison, there are moral problems that are posed when entire communities are devastated because the plant closes and is moving overseas. And there are moral problems posed by all those stakeholders in Enron when nobody's policing them. And that's going to be as big of a topic as issues like gay marriage in this campaign, if I have anything to do about it.
Do you think the Democratic Party needs to be more aggressive? I mean, there are people that know, for example, 4 years ago that the Black Congressional Caucus wanted to challenge the Supreme Court's ruling on the election, the Gore-Bush election. Not a single senator stood with them. I mean, do you think the Democratic Party needs to be more aggressive?
Well, what I think is that the Democratic Party makes a mistake when it gets steamrolled by conservative politicians and then whines about it afterwards. You know, that seems to be a habit that we've had over the last several years, whether with respect to the tax cuts or the war in Iraq or the Patriot Act. We cave and then we complain afterwards, in which case we look not only weak but also petty. And my general way of operating has been to stand firm and be clear on the front end about what I believe in, and to ask tough questions, and to put forward my agenda. But once I've done that, that puts me in a position where I can reach across the aisle and see if I can find common ground with people who disagree with me. And I think that kind of constructive debate is always useful. You know, when I talk about positive campaigns or positive politics, you know, I'm not referring to mealy-mouthed split-the-difference politics, because I think that's failed. I think there has to be a robust debate on all these issues. And what I am constantly suggesting, though, is that we can disagree vigorously on issues without accusing the other side of bad faith or suggesting that somehow they are evil or that they are trying to do harm to people in our party. You know, my sense is that we can disagree and still recognize ourselves and each other and have some empathy for the other person's position.
Senator Barack Obama, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Illinois State Senator Barack Obama. He's currently the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate from Illinois. Coming up, his Republican opponent, conservative commentator Alan Keyes. This is Fresh Air. When the Illinois Republican Party lost its candidate for U.S. Senate to a messy divorce scandal, party leaders looked at a number of options for a replacement, including former Chicago Bears coach Mike Ditka. But in the end, the party settled on someone certain to keep the race lively, conservative commentator and two-time presidential candidate Alan Keyes. Like his opponent Barack Obama, Keyes is African American, but he isn't from Illinois. He'll move from Maryland to run for the seat. Since his last campaign in 2000, Keyes has been writing and speaking for conservative causes. He's hosted radio talk shows and in 2002 had his own MSNBC show called Alan Keyes is Making Sense. Keyes received his undergraduate degree and PhD in government from Harvard. He spent 11 years in the Foreign Service and headed a conservative advocacy group called Citizens Against Government Waste. Besides his presidential campaigns in 1996 and 2000, Keyes was twice the Republican nominee for United States Senate from Maryland in 1998 and 1992. Keyes spoke to us by telephone from his campaign office on Wednesday. Well, Alan Keyes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your opponent, Barack Obama, made quite a bit of his biography of his family lineage in his speech, the kind of diversity in his background. How would you describe your own family background?
Well, I think my family background, my father was a career soldier, my mother was a homemaker, father was from Maryland, mother from North Carolina. I think on the one side of the family, I guess on my mother's side, there were a combination of various things. I even have a little Cherokee Indian blood. And on my father's side, mainly I'm a descendant of slaves who worked on the plantations in Maryland. So I guess it's a pretty standard Black American background.
As a Black student at Harvard in the late 60s, I mean, you had to be part of a very small minority. And this was, of course, at a time when radical politics were sweeping college campuses and the Black Panthers and other militant groups were in full bloom. I wonder, give us a sense of what your political thinking was then. I mean, were you moved at all to left of center politics?
Not really, no. I think that was one of the reasons why I reacted against the things that were taking place at Harvard. I just didn't find that some of the things that were being said and done had much logical or intellectual validity. And I was at that point very serious about trying to understand at a very serious level what the basis was for certain ideas, including the ideas of freedom that are at the basis of the American system. And I was engaged in reading the founders, reading a lot of the philosophers, ancient and modern, that had been involved in their thinking and influenced it. So I had already decided that this was what I wanted to concentrate on. I thought that was, in fact, a serious way to prepare oneself to deal with some of the issues that were obviously very much on my mind, slavery, injustice, segregation, issues involved in the civil rights movement. I think you had to have a response that was more than emotional, a response that involved more than rhetoric and slogans and outbursts, I guess, that might be consonant with your anger. I thought you had to try, to the best of your ability, to really think things through in such a way that you could develop in yourself an effective tool for addressing these issues in the long run, and that was what I was supposed to be doing as a student.
You've been known for advocating an approach for issues in the United States, but in African American communities in particular, of valuing the family, of a personal responsibility, of moral clarity. Are there experiences that sort of crystallized that view for you? Where did you really pull that together?
Well, I wouldn't say, though, that it's experience. I mean, a lot of what I think is the result of thinking. It's the result of trying to look at facts and information. I mean, I wrote a book some years back, Masters of the Dream, and it was during that period that I was working on it, and it took several years, that I really spent a lot of time delving into the history of Black Americans from slavery forward. And the question I had in mind at that point was, given everything that was against people, both in slavery and after, why had people survived? I mentioned in the book that there were writers who had said that if blacks were freed from slavery within a few decades, the black people in America would be extinct because they wouldn't be able to survive, wouldn't be able to take care of themselves. Well, this turned out to be untrue, despite the fact that the environment that prevailed after slavery, after a brief interlude, was really hostile, especially throughout the South where most black people lived. The institutions turned against black people. Things were done to deprive folks of education, to keep them economically without advantage, and so forth and so on. And yet, in the years from the time slavery ended until around 1910, 1915, great progress was made in reconstituting the family in spite of the destruction wrought by slavery and making advances in literacy, in developing structures within a community oppressed by segregation that would support the family and support an approach of responsibility. So I was just very, very struck by this and wanted to try to understand what had made it possible. And I found in the course of the reading and research that I did that two things seemed to be most important, family and faith, in the context of an understanding that these things became the motive, as it were, for pursuing education and laying that kind of a foundation under the individual's ability. So these are all things, by the way, that involve serious moral elements. Because when everything material is against you, the basis for your own self-esteem and self-respect has to be your moral response to your environment, to the people in it, to the family. Because if you don't have anything, what you do have to offer, however, is your ability to remember the obligations you owe to family and community and to really have the self-respect that comes from knowing that you are submitting yourself to a discipline for their sake. And I think lots of black people accepted that and were able to work against the odds to raise decent children, to get them educated and to try to motivate them in spite of the fact that so much in the world was turned against them.
You ran for the Senate twice before in Maryland, and in 1992, I believe I read that you felt that the Republican Party had sort of abandoned your race because you were black. I mean, you saw racism at work in this. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, I know you've thought a lot about affirmative action and such issues. I mean, given that you believe that at least back then that racial discrimination against you played an important role in that political race, this is a big question, but take a crack at it. I mean, how much of a role does racism play in maintaining the conditions that African Americans find themselves in inner cities?
Well, I think nobody who has is a black person in America would deny that racism has played a role in their lives. What I would say is it doesn't play nearly as much a role in the overall reality that we've been talking about as some people say it does. Because I think that right now we live in a world where a lot of doors are open and where other factors are keeping people from pushing against those open doors and moving ahead. And racism, in some sense, the sad truth is that racism is no longer necessary to do that because internal mechanisms of self-propulsion have been dismantled. Was that dismantling the result of racism? That's something I've often thought about, because when you look at the kind of stuff in music and other things that has been pushed at black children, when you look at the preponderant location of abortion clinics, and people always had talked over in history about liquor stores and things of that kind, it seemed like folks were put in an environment which encouraged the breakdown of moral discipline. There was also a sense in which the whole rhetoric of victimization started to push people down a road where instead of being a constructive reminder of reality and where folks were coming from and the challenges they faced, it became almost an excuse for failure and started to discourage people from taking a hold of themselves and moving ahead or giving them feeling that it didn't matter what they did. Because at some point, if you concentrate too much on the negative, that itself becomes debilitating. And so I think all these factors played a role. I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that there was some kind of orchestrated or even conscious racism involved, but at the same time, I think that it would be foolish to deny that a lot of this is not a coincidence and that we have to see in it the operation of an understanding that was influenced by inherited racial stereotypes, inherited attitudes that kind of denigrated the capacity of black folks to address their own situation, and therefore was more open to approaches, understandings that really left black people in the position of helpless victims instead of respecting the capacities that people have in themselves to control their communities and their families and challenging them in a tough-minded way to do it.
Well, let's talk about this Senate race that you are very busily engaged in, and let's get this one question out of the way first. You were quoted in saying in the year 2000, quote, "I deeply resent the destruction of federalism represented by Hillary Clinton's willingness to go into a state she doesn't even live in and pretend to represent people there." You're from Maryland, running in Illinois. Have you changed your mind, or are the standards different in your case?
Oh, no. Standards are the same, and I have not changed my mind. And I think that what Hillary did, I would still criticize roundly, because she self-evidently shopped around America, looked carefully to pick a state that would serve her personal ambition, prepared the ground, went in order to construct a basis for pursuing her personal ambition, and was consciously translating her national standing and reputation into a bid for a seat for power, regardless, really, of the principles of representational integrity and state sovereignty. That's not what I'm doing.
Well, you are a man of some...
I didn't have any thought whatsoever of coming here to run. It was not something that was on my personal agenda in any way. I was approached by people in Illinois by their own decision, which is what makes it formally consistent with sovereignty. But even more important, the federalism issue that I raised is very important to me. But federalism has two components, which, as I've reminded people, are wonderfully summed up in the state motto of Illinois. It's state sovereignty, national union. Federalism has two parts. I think we ought to respect the state sovereignty part and not sacrifice it to personal ambition. But when the principles of our national union are at stake, Lincoln, for instance, recognized in his statesmanship that you must limit your allegiance to state sovereignty in order to defend the principles of our national union. And those principles are at stake in this race because Barack Obama is deeply committed to a stance on abortion and other moral issues that rejects the founding principles of this country.
Well, let's get to
and
that.
And as I thought it through, I said, look, I have a moral obligation after all I've said in life to go in and defend those principles because if I didn't, people would think I was an outrageous hypocrite.
Well, let's get to that. I mean, you made a lot of headlines in the Illinois papers early in this campaign by saying that Barack Obama had, I believe, the slaveholder position on life because of his position on abortion.
Absolutely.
Awfully strong words.
The Not so much just logical. It's just rational. It's an argument. Because the slaveholder position, as reflected in, say, the position of somebody like Stephen Douglas, he was a pro-choice candidate back on slavery. He said he didn't care whether it was voted up or voted down, so long as it was done by popular sovereignty, which meant the people's choice. And Abraham Lincoln came forward and excoriated him because of the stance of indifference to our fundamental moral principles. And Lincoln referred to the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The same indifference exactly is involved in the issue of abortion. The notion that somehow you can look at the life in the womb and say the mother's choice determines our respect for it, when our principles say that every human being, regardless of circumstance, development, or condition, the worth of that human life comes from the Creator. That's what the Declaration states. So just as the slaveholder and people like Douglas were willing to disregard the worth of black Americans on the basis of their choice, so we have people like Obama today saying we can disregard the God-given worth of that baby in the womb because of our choice. And in doing so, they reject the fundamental principle that Lincoln asserted, that Martin Luther King asserted, that Frederick Douglass and others asserted, that we must respect the conscience shaped by the Declaration on which this country was founded. I believe that, and I think that it's clear that Barack Obama does not. And so I'm not calling him names or anything. I'm just saying, look, the principle at stake is the same, and his position is like the position of Stephen Douglas and others who were the slaveholders' favorites in those days.
Well, his position on abortion, it seems to me, is at least colorblind. And when you bring the rhetoric of slaveholder position, it seems to me you're bringing a racial element into that conversation.
I'm sorry. I have to be very blunt. One of the things I learned, because I had slave ancestors, and I, as I said, have deeply looked at and thought about, meditated on the injustice involved in slavery. Slavery is not a racial issue. It's an issue of human justice. And that means that when someone is enslaved in violation of this fundamental premise of human dignity, we are turning our backs on our decent humanity. That's not a racial issue. And abortion is not a racial issue, but the principle involved is the very principle that lay at the heart of the kind of arguments that the slaveholders made in denigration of black Americans. But it was not race, in fact, that caused that denigration. It was an utter disregard for decent humanity.
My guest is Alan Keyes. He is the Republican candidate for the United States Senate from Illinois. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alan Keyes. He is the Republican candidate for the United States Senate seat in Illinois, running against Democrat Barack Obama. On abortion, you said that his position really is in contravention to the fundamental principles of the Declaration of Independence. He has cast you as an extremist on this issue, saying that you would ban abortion in cases of rape and incest. Is that your position?
Oh, yes, it is. It always has been. It's quite clear that there's a deep injustice involved in that. And I often ask people, so we are supposed to punish an innocent child because its parents committed an offense like incest or its father an offense like rape. Would you want to be punished for the deeds of your parents? Would you want to be killed because your parents committed an offense? We know that that's not fair. We know that that violates, just on the face of it, every principle of justice. So, of course, no argument. See, people like to make assertions. He makes assertions.
We should make arguments for the positions that we take, because otherwise we're just engaging in name-calling. And I say, I make an argument for what I believe. Let him come forward with a valid argument for what he believes, and let's compare the two.
Apart from abortion, give us one other issue that you think is going to be critical here and how you think your views are differ from your opponents and why it matters.
Well, I think that we're going to see critical issues that involve, first of all, the defense of the family. From the assault that is being made now on the traditional male-female family. And I think the stand that is taken by Obama is contradictory. He says he respects the family, but he's against everything. The Defense of Marriage Act, the Federal Marriage Amendment, and so forth, that's being done to defend the family.
Well, I believe his position is he supports civil unions, opposes gay marriage. I mean, how would...
I'm telling you, his supposed opposition to gay marriage is false. He is against everything that is required, in fact, to defend traditional marriage against the assault now being waged against it on behalf of gay marriage. So I'll state it quite simply and clearly. That is a contradictory position that is not, in fact, an acceptable and sincere one, and I think that's going to require, on his part, an explanation.
And tell us why you think voters should understand that gay people having their unions recognized are a threat to the traditional heterosexual family.
Meaning, no offense, marriage. We're talking marriage here, and marriage is about procreation. People who cannot, in principle, I'm not talking about incidentally in terms of health or other things like this, but people who cannot, in principle, procreate, cannot get married. It's very simple. It makes marriage an absurdity. It means that marriage is just the relationship of two individuals for the sake of what? Hedonistic self-gratification. This is not what marriage is, and to adopt that view of it means that you have substituted for procreation and the implied responsibilities that are involved in it, a sense that the marriage institution is just, an institution that is devoted to hedonism. And that's not the case, and in fact, to suggest that it is deeply threatens the true understanding of marriage that's needed for people to make a life commitment that is commensurate with the responsibilities of family, procreation, parenting, and so forth.
Can you name all of Chicago's sports teams?
I think I can name most of them, but I have to tell you, when people do that, I tell them I made no bones about it. Nobody's pretending I'm from Illinois. There'll be a learning curve with respect to various things. But as I said in my speech, I may not know all these details, but I think there is a community of heart and spirit between me and the majority of people in Illinois, and we will see the results of that community on Election Day.
Alan Keyes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Alan Keyes. He's currently the Republican candidate for United States Senate from Illinois. Earlier in today's show, we spoke with Democratic candidate Barack Obama. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's interviews were produced by Amy Sallet with Megan Howell. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You are back, baby, on the front lines of the rock and roll revolution.
He's Tony's hitman Silvio Dante on The Sopranos, guitarist with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and the host of a garage band radio show. He's also organized the International Underground Garage Festival, which takes place this weekend in New York. Stephen Van Zandt on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Don't even hit the buttons anymore. Break all them buttons off. This is the coolest radio station in town.